Coal mining in Illinois goes back 200 years.
The peak of the industry was actually in the 1920s, where we produced over 100 million tons of coal and had 100,000 workers.
That's Illinois Coal Association President Phil Gannett. We'll talk with him and a union president about what the future holds for Illinois coal mining. Plus, 17 Illinois school superintendents are suing the state for funding public schools unfairly, especially in rural areas.
Our high school needs approximately $20 to $25 million of repair that we have no idea where that potentially is going to come from.
We'll speak with Cahokia School District Superintendent Art Ryan and WUIS Education Reporter Dusty Rhodes to learn more. And we'll talk about why two Illinois colleges are offering scholarships for competitive video gaming. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Coal mining in Illinois goes back 200 years, with about 100,000 workers at its peak back in the 1920s. About three decades ago, more than 10,000 people worked in the coal mining industry, but last year, that number had dropped below 3,000. We heard a lot during last year's election about the future of coal mining. Now that President Trump has been in office for nearly 3 months, we wanted to talk about what's next for coal mining and coal miners in Illinois. Joining us on the line from Springfield is Phil Gannett, president of the Illinois Coal Association, and we're also joined by Jody Hogue. She's a retired union coal miner and current president of United Mine Workers Local 9819, a union that represents retired and laid-off coal miners. Phil and Jody, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Phil, you joined us on the show last year. At that time, we talked about how employment was down from decades past. According to federal data, the number of Illinois coal employees has gone down from just over 3,700 in 2015 to about 2,800 in 2016. What was behind that drop?
Yeah, we blame that on the war on coal, the regulations coming out of the federal government that made it harder to burn coal in power plants, and there was also a rule that almost took effect called the Stream Protection Rule, which is a total rewrite of the coal mining regulations, federal regulations, and that would have hurt even more. But we had 100,000 megawatts of baseload power from coal go offline from 2010 to 2015, and that's really hurt. Our coal production nationwide went from 1.2 billion tons in 2008 to 740 million tons in 2016. That's a 40% decline, and we blame most of that on the federal regulations.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would argue that environmental regulation has been good for the coal industry, but aren't automation and increased fracking for natural gas also factors in that?
Certainly. Natural gas is a competitor, but coal can compete with natural gas if it's around, even around $3 to $4 per million BTU, which has been above what the level has been lately. It's been a little bit below $3. But we can compete if there's a level playing field, and that means no subsidies granted and things like that. Automation is another factor. In Illinois, about 40% of the coal we mine comes from longwall mining. You can get about 80% of the coal seam out doing that, so it's very, very productive, but it's also very machine-intensive, so it takes fewer people to operate. So the coal industry has become more productive over the past maybe 20, 25 years.
Jody, we just heard Phil explain why there are fewer people working in mines now. You yourself are a retired coal miner. Now you're president of Local 9819. Can you describe the mine where you used to work?
Yes. I worked at Peabody Mine Number 10, and we had three portals. But Peabody Mine 10 was cost plus. So Peabody, they spent a lot of money there because the cost of the coal, it was the cost of the coal plus the cost of running it, and they made a lot of money. But when they stopped the cost plus, that was when they decided to shut it down.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you if that mine was still open. When did that close?
In 1994.
Okay. All right. So, Phil, back to you. On the campaign trail last year, President Trump promised to bring back coal jobs. How optimistic are you feeling right now about the future of the industry?
I think we've got to temper that optimism, Brian. I don't think it can come back to the 2008 levels of 1.2 billion tons of coal nationwide. And the reason for that is what I've already stated. We've lost 400 power plants, coal-burning baseload power plants in this country over the past 8 years, and they're not coming back. What the president can do and what he is doing is he's basically stopping the bleeding. And that is by taking away some of these onerous regulations that make it difficult to either burn coal or to mine coal, which he has peeled back or repealed some of those, and some are in the process. I think that can at least maintain our current position. What I like to think, though, Brian, that in Illinois we've got an advantage. Jody mentioned, you know, a lot of these coal mines closed down after the Clean Air Act was changed in 1990 to require power plants to reduce their sulfur dioxide emissions. Illinois coal, unfortunately, is high in sulfur. And so a lot of power plants, instead of putting on scrubbers to burn Illinois coal, they started shipping in coal from Wyoming that had lower sulfur content. Power plants could meet the emission standards without putting on the expensive equipment. And that's what a lot of power plants did. In fact, it's a tragedy that the mine that Jody worked at, there was a power plant built on top of that. And the coal came out of the ground, went into the power plant, and now coal comes from Wyoming to be burned in that power plant. And so we lost a lot of jobs from 10,000 jobs in 1990 to about 3,500 in 2003. But the advantage we had built up since then is that 85% of our coal went out of state. So our coal operators know how to get the coal to the end users, even in Europe and exporting out of the country. And we have low cost to produce the coal. Our coal seams are fairly large, 6 to 7 feet thick. Our extraction costs are relatively low. And in a shrinking marketplace, the low cost producer is going to prevail. And I think that's going to be a plus in Illinois. But we're never going to come back to the 10,000 jobs that we had in 1990.
Jody, how about you? As a former coal miner, do you think there's still a future for coal in the state?
I'm really hesitant to say there is, because with the price, the way they're fracking and getting the natural gas, I just don't see it coming back. If they start building coal plants, then I'll realize it's going to come back.
And Jody, you represent a union made up of retired and laid off coal miners, and we've been talking about whether there's a future in terms of more jobs. But what are you hearing from the retirees and laid off workers in your union?
Well, right now, since it is a retiree local mostly, our workers, our members, are looking at losing their health care at the end of this month. So that right now is the biggest problem we have. In Illinois, the health care brings in so much money. I mean, health care, almost $33 million is going to be lost if they lose their health care. It's just really astronomical. And this is all downstate. I'd say from Springfield south is where it's going to happen. So there's going to be a lot of trickle down from that, the hospitals, the insurance, or the doctors, and the local stores are going to be hurt if this bill doesn't get passed.
And Jody, have you been out to Washington, D.C. to talk to lawmakers about this issue?
Yes, I've been there 3 times, and I'm going again the end of this month. We're having good luck as far as getting co-sponsors. They're all willing to vote for the bill, but right now, Senator McConnell and Paul Ryan are not wanting to take it to the floor for a vote. If we can get it to the floor for a vote, then I think we can get this bill passed. This bill also does not include taxpayers' money. The money was appropriated back in the 90s to cover this, but it only covers people that was retired before 94. If we can get the bill passed to throw the other people into that, then they would be covered with their health care. So that's what we're working on right now.
Okay. Phil, I imagine there might be some listeners who are thinking, you know, why invest in trying to bring back coal jobs when we could be putting that investment toward solar energy jobs, wind jobs that are better for the environment? What's your response to those questions?
Well, the coal industry generally has been supportive of an all-of-the-above strategy for the nation's energy, and that means, you know, renewables as well. The problem with renewables is that they are intermittent sources of energy. They don't operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you need a baseload power source in order to make sure that the energy is going to be there when you want to flick on that light switch. And that means it's either from nuclear power, from coal, or from natural gas. Those are the three major sources of baseload power. So, and I keep on seeing these stories, and I scratch my head. A community wants to be 100% powered by renewables. But what do you do when the wind doesn't blow, when the sun doesn't shine? You need baseload power to back that up. So I don't think coal's going away. It's the cheapest form of that we have to create energy in this country, and we have a plentiful supply. In fact, coal is very abundant in the state of Illinois, and so we should use it. And there are ways to burn the coal. That, in fact, we have the strictest air emissions limits of any country in the world. And in the last 30 years, electricity from coal had doubled. I'll have to go back about 2 years on this because that number's gone down. But we've doubled the amount of electricity we make from coal, but yet we've reduced all emissions by 70%. And I think there's just this fallacy out there that coal is bad and harmful, and I think that the government has handled that in a way to reduce the emissions to protect the health of citizens.
And Jody, let me ask you, you know, as a retired coal miner, I believe you live in Taylorville now. You know, people who might have in past years, you know, been able to get a job at the coal mine, you know, close to them, what are they doing for work these days?
Well, there's a lot of young people that aren't finding jobs. Around Taylorville, there just are no jobs. Years ago, there was little factories all around, plus the coal mines. There was, I know myself, from my family, my grandfathers both worked in mines. All my uncles, my father was a coal miner. My brother was a coal miner. So it's been a family thing. Whereas now, where they could go to the coal mines or they could go to the little factories, it's just not there now.
And before we let you go, both of you, I'll start with you, Phil. If you could say one thing to President Trump and Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate President Mitch McConnell, for that matter, about coal mining and coal miners in Illinois, what would you say to them?
Well, I'd say keep on doing what you're doing. The president last week signed an executive order at EPA that pulled back on most of the regulations that were going to be make it hard to burn coal. I think from our standpoint, in terms of the industry and helping it along, keep on doing what you're doing because so far so good. But I want to temper that again. You know, coal's not going to be back to where it was even in Jody's time, 1994. Certainly not to the 1920s in terms of the employment. But if we can maintain what we have, modest increase in jobs, they're good paying jobs in parts of the state that really need that help. And so keep on doing what they're doing.
Jody, same question to you.
Okay. I agree with what he's saying. If they can bring coal back, I'm all for it. If they can do it cleaner and if they can do it safer. I just don't want to see regulations that include safety regulations go down the tube. But I'm all for it coming back if they can do it.
Jody Hoag, retired union coal miner, current president of United Mine Workers Local 9819, and Phil Gannett, president of the Illinois Coal Association. Thank you both for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And joining us on the line now from Denver, Colorado, is Lee Patterson. It's Inside Energy is a public media program focused on American energy issues, and Lee reports for Inside Energy. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Oh, we just got a little bit of time here before our break, Lee, but you just heard from Phil Gannett and Jody Hoag. In that conversation, you were able to listen in on what stood out to you.
Well, sure. So in that conversation, your guest, Phil Gannett, in his first answer, put blame pretty squarely on the war on coal in terms of decreasing coal production. And he did agree that natural gas is a competitor, but there was definitely an emphasis on that phrase we've heard so often, the war on coal. And I think, you know, just for some context, in 2016, U.S. coal production was at its lowest level since 1978. And as Phil mentioned, coal production has been falling steadily since 2008. And there are, you know, there are several forces behind this trend. A biggie are those market forces. Low natural gas prices, natural gas-fired power plants are becoming more efficient. They're also cheaper to build than coal-fired power plants. Another factor is the falling cost of renewables. Some states have renewable portfolio standards, and those are states that would be customers for Wyoming coal and Illinois coal. And lastly, that coal export market just isn't there, and that's largely thanks to falling and flat international demand. You know, China comes to mind, for example. Growth there is just not what it used to be.
All right, Lee, we'll have to pick this up after the break, but stay with us. Lee Patterson from Inside Energy will talk a little bit more about the future of coal. That's coming up here on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're talking with Lee Patterson, a reporter with Inside Energy based in Colorado. And before we had to cut you off before that break, Lee, it seems like the market forces are playing a much bigger role in the decline of coal than what Phil was describing in our first segment.
Yes, they absolutely are. And I would think experts and coal company executives would agree on that. I mean, executives of the largest coal companies in the country have attributed the decline in coal production largely to market forces. Now, as I was saying before the break, we can't ignore regulations. And I think experts and coal industry folks would agree that regulations absolutely play a role, specifically what's known as the MATS rule, the Mercury Air Toxic Standards. That was put in place a couple of years ago, maybe 2011, 2012, and a slew of old coal-fired power plants did shut down. The reason they shut down is because it was really just too expensive to, you know, comply and retrofit the plant with the equipment needed to comply with that MATS rule. But I think it's really important to note that the coal industry does not operate in a vacuum. There are many other issues and interests involved, and I think what I'm getting at, of course, is climate change. Climate change is a reality, and environmental regulations like the Clean Power Plan is one way to reduce emissions and fight global warming.
Lee, you've been reporting on these issues out of Colorado. How does what you heard from Phil and Jody compare with what you're seeing in your part of the country?
Sure. So a lot of the same concerns. I think that folks who live in coal mining communities in Colorado and in Wyoming, decline in production and lost jobs, they feel it, and they feel it in a very, very acute way. You know, remember, coal mining jobs, these are folks make a good yearly income. The average yearly income for a coal miner in the West is between $80,000 and $90,000 a year. And coal dollars also play a large role in state budgets. And so these changes, while not completely due to regulations and really have a lot more to do with market forces than actions taken by the Obama administration, I can see, you know, I do understand that perspective. Folks feel attacked. They feel attacked, and their livelihoods are at stake, and the economies of their states are in a precarious position. And so I can understand where both Phil and Judy are coming from. I did actually want to address one more thing that Phil brought up, and mm-hmm. those are subsidies to the renewable industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad he brought up those subsidies, because that's actually something that Inside Energy has looked at. We analyzed data from 2013. And it's true, the renewable industry does get sizable subsidies. For example, in 2013, the wind industry received around $6 billion in both direct funding and tax breaks from the federal government. But also, the fossil fuel industry received subsidies as well that totaled to around $4 billion, mostly in tax breaks. So when we have that conversation about subsidies, it's not only about the renewable industry.
Interesting. Has the Trump administration affected what you've been hearing about coal, and what have you been hearing here over the last few months?
Yeah, so definitely. What I've been hearing from folks in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, and that's of course where most of our coal comes from in the U.S. The Powder River Basin produces around 40% of U.S. coal. And I would say that, you know, miners are hopeful. They are hopeful that Trump will follow through on those promises for all of the reasons we were just talking about. I think it's a really scary thing to have the only job you've ever known, and maybe the only job your, you know, parents and grandparents have ever known. It's scary to lose that. But I think folks are also practical. Coal miners understand that they work in the business, right? So they know how coal markets work. And they don't think that everything can possibly ever go back to the way that it was. I will say that kind of an interesting anecdote is, before the election, I heard from several folks in Gillette, you know, over the summer, that they were actually holding off on making big financial decisions, you know, like buying a home or a new truck or whatever, until after the election. So there is faith in President Trump for sure, but I would say, they're cautiously optimistic.
Final question before we let you go here, Lee. Coal has certainly gotten a lot of attention over the past several years for a relatively small number of jobs nationwide. Why do you think we've been hearing so much about the coal industry?
That's a great question. And it's interesting because right now, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we have maybe around 50,000 coal miners in the U.S., and that's down from, gosh, maybe 180,000 decades ago. So we're talking about a relatively small number of folks actually employed in that workforce. And I think there are a few things going on. I think Americans have almost a nostalgic attachment to that kind of work that is, you know, so typically American, and that is such a part of our American history. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was based on the availability of coal and the discovery of coal. And there's something very American about a coal miner in a hard hat going down to work in those mines. It's a little harder to wrap your head around what someone working in, you know, retail or healthcare, like what that job actually looks like. Does that make sense? It's sort of this tangible thing people can wrap their heads around. And in some ways there's this association of loss of a certain type of economy, a blue collar economy in which someone could graduate from high school and get a really solid job that they could go to every day for the next 30 years and support their family on a really strong income. And the economy is changing, and those jobs are no longer what they used to be. And so I think largely it's emotional and it's cultural.
Lee Patterson, reporter with Inside Energy, based in Denver, Colorado. Thank you so much, Lee, for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Schools in small cities and rural areas in Illinois have been struggling as a result of a decline in state funding over the years and a funding formula that they say is inequitable. Last week, 17 school superintendents filed a lawsuit against the state of Illinois, asking Governor Bruce Rauner and the State Board of Education to come up with a new funding formula that would help all Illinois schools meet the state's learning standards. To learn more about this, I'm joined on the line from Springfield by WUIS education reporter Dusty Rhodes. Also on the line with me from the East St. Louis area is Superintendent Art Ryan of the Cahokia School District. Dusty and Superintendent Ryan, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks.
Dusty, let's start with you. Could you just give us a brief summary of what this lawsuit is all about?
Well, there's no disagreement about whether or not funding is inequitable. That's one thing that everybody agrees on, from the governor to the legislators to school superintendents across the state. And the problem with that is that the one thing that is equal is the test that kids have to take. And the lawsuit is about how to help the kids that don't have enough funding, the school districts that don't have enough funding, come up to a level where they can have a good shot at scoring well on those standardized tests, just like the kids in the rich school districts. Is that about it, Superintendent Ryan?
I'd say that's a good assessment, yes.
All right. Art Ryan, let's bring you into this conversation. What have the past few years been like for schools in your district?
Well, in our district, you know, actually the last 5 years or so have been really rough. Over the last 5 years, from the funding mechanism, we've actually been shorted about $14 million. Based on those shortfalls, we've had to eliminate about 80 teaching positions. We've closed three schools. There's been several after-school programs and sports that have had to be eliminated, you know, all just to be able to stay within our budget that we're being done by the state. And again, you know, our kids and the programs that we're able to offer them are the ones that are suffering the most in this process.
Sure. And Art, what else have you done before this lawsuit to try and get lawmakers' attention on this issue?
Well, I mean, we make pretty much annual visits to Springfield to talk about this. You may recall about a year and a half ago, there was a rally in Vandalia, which our school district attended to back when they were trying to determine whether they were going to fund education for this current, you know, 16-17 school year. You know, I talked to my local legislators with great regularity, sharing with them, you know, the problems that we face and the issues that you know we have to deal with. And you know, again, we just basically keep trying to be a squeaky wheel.
Sure. Dusty, you've been in touch with superintendents in other school districts that are involved in this lawsuit as well. Are they facing similar circumstances to what Art Ryan is describing?
Yes, and there are plenty of other districts that aren't even in the lawsuit. It's kind of a situation where it's like all the students are being asked to run a marathon, and some of them are given shoes and some of them aren't. It's just, you know, but it's the same race with the same finish line.
Sure. And Art, if the funding formula is, you know, it's if the state funds it fully as they're supposed to each year, does that solve this problem for districts like yours?
Are you talking about the current funding program?
Yes, the current formula.
To be honest with you, I don't know that it would, because, you know, now again, over the last 4 to 5 years, the funding has been prorated by roughly 11%. We've only gotten about 89% of our funding. This current school year, the state did fund state aid at 100%, but there are, you know, extra categories called categoricals, which are like transportation, extra funding for special ed, lunch programs, so on. Those categoricals have not been funded at all. So even though we gained extra money by fully funding the state aid, we've lost almost $4 million in the categoricals that they haven't funded. So the net effect is actually still a loss to us over what we, you know, normally would have had.
Sure. And Art, what do you think an equitable school funding formula would look like?
Well, as far as the amount, to be honest with you, I have no idea. But I think what needs to be taken into account is you know the district's poverty level, the EAV. You know, again, if the local funding mechanism is still going to continue to be based on property tax and the value of the homes in the community, that has got to be factored in. You know, again, in my community, for example, probably the average home is maybe in the $30,000 to $50,000 range, where most of the other communities that surrounds my district would be more in the $100,000 to $150,000 range. So, you know, again, in my district, our current property tax rate is $13.08. You know, which is probably easily one of the top four or five rates in the district. We're certainly the highest in this area, and you know, even with that high rate, you know, and because of the low EAV in our district, it only generates about $9 million. You know, so you know, we are overburdening our local communities with taxes just to be able to keep the doors open. You know, and these are all people that can barely get by themselves because of you know the nature of their circumstances.
Dusty, yeah, I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier. You said that the current formula is like making all kids run the same marathon. Some are given shoes and some aren't. I'm curious if you can give us a concrete example of how that plays out in schools across the state.
Well, okay. For example, everybody's heard of the PARC test. That's the standardized test that kids now take. And at the end of the year, it's designed to be taken on computers. I've heard district superintendents testify in committee that they have one-to-one technology, meaning every child has some type of computer, from pre-kindergarten on. And I've heard other district superintendents testify in committees that they have a little cart of laptops that they that gets trundled around through the school, and kids get to use it on, you know, Tuesday or Thursday. That's not a level playing field. And that's just one example. There are districts that have a whole variety of advanced placement tests available, you know, advanced placement courses available for their students. There are plenty of districts that have maybe three or four different advanced placement courses. Just complete different world.
Sure. Art, back to you. The lawsuit was filed last Wednesday. What response, if any, have you heard from Governor Rauner or the State Board of Education?
We've had no direct correspondence, but it just so happened that the day that we were filing that suit, Governor Rauner was actually down in our area in Alton. So the local news was able to interview him, and I did see, you know, his response was that, you know, he basically understood and agreed. He said he's right that the current funding formula isn't fair. Now, again, whether or not that's going to translate into him working with someone to try and get something done, you know, we'll see. I'm sure we're all aware of the political climate in Springfield and how tough it is for anything to happen. But, you know, as Dusty said when we first started, I don't think there's anyone that disagrees that the current mechanism isn't fair. The issue is coming up with a solution that everybody's willing to agree to.
Superintendent Art Ryan from the Cahokia School District near East St. Louis, and Dusty Rhodes, education reporter with WUIS Public Radio in Springfield. Dusty, Superintendent Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Competitive video gaming, or esports, is already a multi-million dollar professional industry, with revenues projected to pass $1 billion worldwide by next year. And recently, colleges and universities in the U.S. have started to get in on the action as well. Recently, Illinois College in Jacksonville announced that they'll be offering scholarships for students hoping to play League of Legends competitively. They're the second university in Illinois to offer this, in addition to Robert Morris University. Joining us now on the line from Jacksonville is Christian Matlock. He's the head coach of esports at Illinois College. Christian, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You've been playing video games all your life. I'm curious, when did you realize it could be part of a competitive league in the same way that sports like football or basketball are?
I was really introduced to gaming as an esport in 2011 when I got hooked on to League of Legends to start. I had always kind of been in gaming, and I saw a lot of the same kind of it really helps you develop skills like critical thinking, decision making, and all of that. But there wasn't really an outlet in terms of a sporting outlet quite yet. And then that has really started to surge here in the last, 6-7 years or so.
Sure. I'm sure you're used to talking with skeptical parents or colleagues who might say that video games can't possibly be a sport or at least something that you can make money from. How do you answer that?
Basically just kind of talking about I see so many of the same parallels, in League of Legends particularly, it has that same kind of 5-on-5 like basketball. Every player in the game on a team has a very specific role and position that they play, just like you would see in basketball. There's all these different kinds of parallels there, and it also helps in kind of developing the same life skills that you would see in traditional sports like teamwork, dedication, perseverance, integrity, sportsmanship, all of the same kind of pillars that you kind of learn through traditional sports is now getting applied to gaming in that esport environment.
For listeners who might not be familiar, what does an esports match look and feel like?
It's very much similar, especially from a spectator standpoint, to traditional sports. You're on the edge of your seat watching, someone like Aaron Rodgers or something throw a 60-yard bomb for a touchdown in the waning seconds. Well, that similar kind of thing happens where all of this intensity has built up to this one moment, make or break for both sides of the match. And, to see all the flashing lights and colors, and you're watching health bars drain down, and they disengage, re-engage, and all of those different things. It's very, very similar in that regard, that you're on the edge of your seat anticipating what's going to happen next. How are they going to get over this obstacle? How are they going to get down the field? How are they going to get that ball in the end zone? Whatever it might be, there, it all has that same kind of what's about to happen. I'm a huge hockey fan myself, and, being in the playoffs now, it has that same kind of deal. Every match is so dramatic and every match is so pivotal. Everything is just, there's a lot of weight in what's going on, that it's almost identical to the way that traditional sports are going right now.
Yeah, there are competitions for all kinds of games out there, from Halo to Super Smash Brothers, but your team is focused on just one game, League of Legends, one of the most popular video games in the esports world. For listeners who might not know about it, how does League of Legends work?
So like I said, it's kind of it's a 5-on-5 game. Essentially, the end game goal is to destroy what's called the enemy team's nexus. That's just basically the home base. There's three different lanes that have these little guys called minions constantly pushing in, and the overall way to get to the base is really manipulating those waves to slowly make your push across the map and along the way kind of destroying enemy structures that stand in your way. So it's a lot of teamwork, a lot of map manipulation, moving all your guys in a coordinated effort to make the most efficient push and get the most out of it before you have to kind of reset and do it all over again. So there's a lot of different droves is kind of how it goes through. You have to weather some of the enemy storm and then kind of create your own as you make your way to the enemy nexus to win.
I'm curious, what makes a good League of Legends teammate?
A big thing for me is really being able to having a compatible personality. And that comes a lot from being positive when things go wrong and being knowledgeable when things are going right. And then also being able to communicate very well. Those are the three big things, is keeping a level head, communication, and really just staying optimistic about the outcome.
Christian, you've also worked in the pro esports world. Why did you decide to start a college team?
During my time in professional esports, I was really noticing that it's such a new industry that those involved right now might not have the best grasp on how to approach it in a professional manner. So I really saw an opportunity for colleges to help develop that next wave of professionalism in the younger generations and things, and really getting in on the ground floor of that, wanting to help propel esports to new heights by making sure that those entering the workforce in esports are prepared on the mental side of things. You know, they're ready to act professionally. They're ready to, you know, show up to practices on time and everything. It's actually kind of incredible how serious it is, but how playfully it's taken. Like you had mentioned in the introduction, you know, there's a lot of money being invested into this industry, and some of the personalities don't really seem to grasp the gravity of that situation. So I thought this would, colleges and youth programs and everything can really kind of start pushing the seriousness side of gaming.
And you're working at Illinois College under the umbrella of athletics. What's it like to share an office with like the football team or the basketball team?
It's pretty interesting. Every day, you know, I hear the weight room going on and it's really loud. And, you know, I've never been in an environment where that's been, there's all this external noise and everything. So it's been pretty interesting on that front. But so far, everyone in the office has been super supportive and really helping me think through the process on how this can move from just being kind of a hobby and really taking it seriously. Things like, you know, managing practice times, making sure, you know, students are going to stay academically eligible, and how I can kind of help motivate them to succeed in the classroom. It's been great having the Illinois College staff on my side and really helping me think through the process of getting this team going.
Do you see a lot of growth coming for colleges and esports?
Oh, tremendous. I'm working with we're looking to be a member school of the National Association for Collegiate Esports, the NACE. And in speaking with them, they had, I had learned that approximately 7 or so schools, I think it was last summer, had scholarship programs, and that has more than doubled this year alone. So things have really been progressing and really booming for collegiate esports, and it's really great to just kind of get in on the early wave of that and have an opportunity to really mold what the model is going to be going forward.
Could you walk us through the recruiting process for you? How do you go about, you know, trying to scout esports players and bring them to Illinois College?
Yeah, so there's quite a few different avenues. There are high school leagues and tournaments going on all over the place. And, you know, it's really been about finding ways to watch those matches, get in touch with those school administrators and see what kind of infrastructure they already have. If it's a student-run club, or if it's, you know, a true, you know, integrated into their athletics already as well, and just kind of getting in touch with them and, you know, saying, hey, I really like this talent on your team. Would you mind getting me in contact? You know, I can talk about the opportunity we have at Illinois College and moving forward from there.
Sure. Are esports teams single gender, or can anyone be involved?
That's the great thing about video games, I think, is it's approachable for anyone, you know, any creed, any race, any culture, any gender. It's a very approachable and level playing field. So anyone is able to pick it up and be good. And I think that's what makes these games so great, is that there's the possibility for so much diversity. I actually remember hearing that studies have shown around 40% of all of casual gamers are female, but unfortunately we're only seeing about 1% of the pro scene, even less than that, being female. So there's a lot of strides being pushed there to really get a little more inclusive, and I think that offering these collegiate opportunities is one of those initiatives, one of those efforts that's really going to help level that field out a little bit.
Sure. How do you try to encourage more women to take part in esports teams?
I think some of it has to do with confidence with it being such a male dominant industry right now, there's just that that thought process of, well, I don't have a chance, and that's not true at all. You know, what I look at is a username, and whoever's on the other side of that username, that's kind of, you know, don't get me wrong, that plays a huge part, you know, when we're talking about personalities being compatible and everything, but the gender or anything like that doesn't really matter. It's about your approach to the game and how you kind of conduct yourself. And if you can, if you take this seriously and show up to practices and really, really get involved with your team and everything, then you have just as much of a shot as anyone else. And I think just kind of getting that message out that this is something for everyone is what has kind of been holding people back, is that everyone thinks that this is such an exclusive club. You have to be the cream of the crop, the number one, or you're not going to make it. And right now, as things kind of continue to grow and develop, you know, everyone is going to have an opportunity here. If you just take it seriously, the skills will come. It's just like any other skill. You have to practice and train and learn. So if you have that open-mindedness to do that, then, the world is, your cloister. Anything can happen.
Got just about a minute here left, Christian. A few days ago, you tweeted something in response to the AP style book, adding the word esports. And you said, it's kind of weird how happy this AP news about esports makes me. Normalize us already. I think we've earned it. Why do you think normalizing of esports is so important?
There's this huge stigma going around that, you know, all of our gamers are, you know, they're in a dark room, you know, hunched over their keyboards, looking at a computer screen, staying by themselves. And with the introduction of esports, it's not that anymore. It's a social environment. It's a huge movement. And, you know, lifelong friendships are being forged over gaming now, which is something you probably couldn't say over Super Mario Bros. Or Pong. But now with, you know, Halo, League of Legends, Dota, all of these things, that it's become a huge culture. You know, it's time to, I think, kind of meet students where they're at and utilize their passion to produce the next wave of young professionals. And that's kind of what I think needs to be normalized in order to get to that next step.
Christian Matlock is the head coach of esports at Illinois College in Jacksonville. Christian, thanks so much for joining us on the 21st.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity here.
And finally, before we go, last night the defending World Series champion Chicago Cubs took to the field for their home opener against the LA Dodgers. And before the game, they raised their first World Series banner in more than a century.
There it is, the 2016 World Championship banner, very similar to the 1907 and 1908. Navy blue, white lettering, red stripes on the top and bottom. It seems to me that the organization might leave some more spaces for more poles, for more championship banners in the years to come.
Ah, this Cubs fan likes the sound of that. That's WSCR's Pat Hughes. The Cubs celebrated in style with a 3-2 win on a walk-off single by Anthony Rizzo last night. That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. The 21st is produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yun and Nick Vance from University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.